Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Foreign Seed by Allison Alsop, narrated by Kyle Snyder. And now, in the heart of the night, like a watchman, he discovers that the night shows mankind, its calls, its lights, its worries. This single star in the shadow, the isolation of a house. One of them goes out, a house that closes itself on its love. From Vol de Nuit, Night Flight, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, 1931. Part 1. Chapter 1. Nanking, China, Thursday, June 5th, 1918. By the time Sokobin receives the Consul General's wire, the American explorer has been missing for some 4 days, and the affair is already well muddled. From what Sokobin can gather, Frank Meyer, 42, was last seen aboard the SS Fang Yang Maru just before midnight on June 1st. According to the passenger manifest, Meyer and his Chinese boy boarded the steamer with the intention of disembarking at Shanghai. But the following morning, the captain declared Meyer missing, most likely having gone overboard late the night before near the industrial city of Wuhu, some 200 miles from the coast and 60 miles from Vice Consul Sokobin's office in Nanking. The SS Fang Yang Maru docked in Shanghai yesterday, where the American staff has been at work inspecting the ship and interviewing the crew. The dossier is to arrive sometime tomorrow. In the interim, Sokobin is to make preparations to head upriver to Wuhu, where, as the nearest American officer of rank, he is to organize the search for Meyer, or what remains of him.
"Spare no effort in ascertaining Mr. Meyer's whereabouts," the Consul General's message concludes. "Leave no stone unturned."
Sokobin stares at the paper, willing the words to evaporate. There's no saying how long the search will take, if he can even find Meyer at all. After 4 days, the missing man could be anywhere. The river is vast, and a body in the water leaves no trail, no trace, save itself. Nor is Sokobin particularly keen on the idea of coming up empty-handed on his first major file as vice consul. Failure straight out of the gate. Sokobin rereads the lengthy wire, looking for any concession to the obvious, that the missing man has drowned in the Yangtze, but finds none. As if after years of trekking through China's backwaters, the rough-and-tumble explorer has somehow managed to lose himself aboard a steamship. Of course, there's a chance, albeit small. Meyer is still alive. After 7 years in country, Sokobin has gleaned that not every American who disappears wishes to be found. China readily obliges the man intent on losing himself in any number of ways. Gambling, opium, alcohol, salacious prostitutes, violent entanglements. Sokobin was privy to a dozen such cases while posted to Shanghai. Usually, the missing man turned up within a few days, still very much alive and stinking of whiskey, and with all the explanation needed etched across his unshaven face. If Sokobin is lucky, Meyer will prove one of these. But it's a stretch. Meyer disappeared from a passenger boat, not some back-alley den or brothel. And having once met the man, Sokobin would hardly count him among the ranks of the reckless or dissolute. Meyer's reputation as a rugged explorer of the remote Chinese interior precedes him, and his expeditions on behalf of the United States Department of Agriculture have been notable enough to make the international papers. Sokobin has seen the photographs. Meyer in lean profile, one boot perched on a snow-capped mountaintop, or fording a rushing river while a crew of porters trails behind. Not exactly the type to throw years of hard-earned research away on easy temptation or vice. No, Sokobin thinks. Had Meyer been given to excessive risk, he would have certainly met his end falling off a cliff
or at the blade of bandits years ago. Indeed, only an exceptionally aware and calculating man could have lasted this long in China's backwaters. Rather, Sokoban's instincts are already whispering that it's the rarer, trickier kind of case at work here. The slippery sort that never gets closed, only shuffled down the stack and eventually stuffed in the file cabinet. The sort of case whose causes no one, not even the missing themselves, could ever put a name to. Sokoban has been witness to a few such cases, and while he's never considered himself the morbid or superstitious type, he knows this to be true. Men hope to outrun all sorts of dark beasts when they come east, only to wake one day and find their monsters still scuttling about the dank holds of their minds. He lifts the Scrimshaw paperweight at the edge of his desk, adding the Consul General's wire to the pile, and runs his fingers over the polished ivory. A tick, he knows, but the simple act helps sort his thoughts. Despite the heat, the paperweight somehow always manages to remain cool to the touch. Its etched top depicts a typical Chinese pastoral, a sampan floating past a tree-topped cliff and a cluster of V-shaped slits meant to imply a flock of birds. His college mentor, Everton, gave him the Scrimshaw as a graduation gift years ago. Sokoban can still hear the professor's dry Connecticut clip slicing the classroom's stale air, the sharp tap of his chalk on the slate.
"Mark my words, gentlemen. China is very old and full of ghosts."
Sokoban reaches for his handkerchief, pressing it to his forehead. The Meyer case is only a few minutes old. Even so, he can already feel it pushing down on his shoulders. He thinks of the package of Chesterfields waiting in his bottom desk drawer, but pushes away the thought.
"No," he thinks, "not yet."
The fan groans overhead, stirring the damp air and making the console's cable flutter like a trapped moth beneath the Scrimshaw. Among the stack are the week's memoranda from Peking and Shanghai. Of late, the news is rarely good. Missionaries kidnapped, mailboats captured, scattered skirmishes between more military factions than anyone can keep track of. And in the past few days, intelligence of yet another province plotting to break away. At times, it's hard to know who's in charge of the country, the Republicans in Peking, or the local rebel warlords. It's been 6 years since the Dragon Throne toppled nearly overnight, and yet nothing solid has surfaced to fill the imperial void. So far, Nanking to the coast at Shanghai has held firm. But further inland, the seams are badly frayed. Bit by bit, the country is rupturing. Chaos. Civil war. Sokoban sees them coming. If only Britain and the States weren't entrenched in the conflict in Europe, the West might help to restore some order. But, as of now, there's nothing to spare, save a few American gunships. From where Sokoban sits, it looks like China's one shot at democracy may have expired before it even began. And now, Meyer. He swivels toward the room's singular window, only to remember that the secretary, Miss Petrie, has already closed the curtains against the afternoon sun. The heavy fabric glows orange. Summer is close, hovering. Despite the heat, he tugs open the drapes and squints into the glare. Beyond the glass, the Yangtze stretches into turbid infinity. The river. One way or another, everything here seems to come back to it. He tracks a steamer inching across the panes. The boat's stacks send up a thick black cloud, and again he thinks of the cigarettes waiting in the bottom drawer. The smoking is a recent development, one that's already found a much firmer hold than Sokoban would care to admit, and he tells himself to hold off, if only to prove he can. So far, he's avoided indulging in front of the staff. Not that Miss Petrie or Mr. Wyndham, the junior clerk, would take issue. and the senior clerk, Mr. Brundage, must inhale a dozen cigarettes a day. Even so, Sokoban doesn't like sharing the act. The Chesterfields are private, a ritual for him alone. He can feel himself delaying on Meyer, the self-doubt creeping in. But there's no getting around a direct order from the Consul General. If Sokoban's going to get himself upriver to Woohoo by tomorrow night, he needs to set things in motion now. He considers logistics, most pressingly the need for an interpreter. His own Mandarin is passable when it comes to official functions. The myriad local dialects, however, continue to elude him. Assuming Meyer doesn't turn up by tomorrow evening, he'll need help with hiring a crew to comb the water. Sokoban pushes the image away before it can take shape. He swivels back toward his desk, calling for the junior clerk through the open doorway. Wyndham quickly appears, his shirt sleeves rolled and cheeks flush. A lock of strawberry blonde hairs come loose from the slicked folds and spirals over his smooth brow. The clerk originally hails from farm country, somewhere in Indiana or Illinois. Sokoban can never remember which.
Sir?
You haven't received word from any of the patrol stations about someone pulling a white body from the river?
No, sir.
Well, send dispatches to all the patrol stations between here and Woohoo just to be sure. Otherwise, it looks like I'll need to head up there tomorrow evening.
Is this about the wire that just came in?
Yes. Frank Meyer, the explorer. He's with agriculture.
I've heard the name, sir.
Sokoban nods. It seems he went missing from a steamer a few days ago.
Missing, sir? From a steamer?
Sokoban knows what the clerk is thinking, because he's been thinking the same thing from the moment he read the Consul General's cable. Meyer is dead. Sunk into the river's depths, never to be found. But Sokoban isn't a clerk anymore. He's a man of rank. The official line is his to toe. That's correct, Mr. Wyndham. Missing until proven otherwise.
Understood, sir.
Wyndham pushes back the errant lock of hair. It's no use. And within seconds, the long curl has slipped down again. I'll need an interpreter. Neither of the last two. Sokoban has had his fill of the Mandarin's pomp and fuss. There's no telling what he'll meet with upriver. What he needs is a modern man. Calm. Smart. Forward-thinking. Provided one can be found. Wyndham purses his lips.
I believe there's only one other approved interpreter on the list, sir. Mr. Lin.
Do you know him?
No, sir. But his CV should be in the files.
Bring it here, then. He can't be any worse than the others. Meanwhile, see if he's available.
Will do, sir. How long should I tell him you expect to be gone?
Sokoban exhales. Of course, there's no way to know. A few days, maybe more. Explain that I'm waiting on the dossier to come from the Shanghai office tomorrow afternoon. We'll be leaving soon after it arrives, assuming Meyer doesn't surface before then. Sokoban cringes at the word choice. Sloppy.
By train or boat?
Ferry. The last run, I expect. Reserve a pair of tickets, if you would.
Yes, sir. Anything else?
Sokoban runs his fingers over the scrimshaw. He's debating whether or not to contact Arthur Chase, his old classmate from college, now in Woohoo and working for Standard Oil of New York. Sokoban isn't sure he wants to drag Chase into the Meyer affair. In truth, he isn't sure he wants to see Chase at all. The last time they met with one another was 4 or 5 months ago, before Sokoban's transfer to Nanking in March. Still, Arthur knows that stretch of river, and his house will be far more comfortable than any hotel.
Sir?
Wyndham taps his fingers against the threshold. Not impatiently, Sokoban knows, only anxious to please. The clerk is terribly young, no more than 20, with skin the color of an unbaked biscuit.
Sokoban considers that he and Chase would have been no older when they first met in Everton's class. Somehow it seems impossible they were ever so new.
"Yes, one more item," Sokoban says. "Wire my friend Arthur Chase. See if he can put us up a few nights. Miss Petrie has the address. That's all for now. Thank you."
Wyndham withdraws. Sokoban runs his fingers over the paperweight, its tiny sampan forever adrift. It's been nearly 3 years since Everton passed, dropped by a stroke while raking leaves from his lawn. If not for Chase, the years at university, even Manhattan itself, would seem little more than a dream. Once more his eyes fall to the bottom drawer. He pictures the cigarettes within, the blue envelopes from his brother resting beneath. He can generally last until late afternoon, sometimes even until the office closes before lighting up. But not today. Not with the Meyer dossier waiting to land on his desk. He's about to reach for the handle of the drawer when he hears a cough. Wyndham is back in the doorway, his blue eyes blinking, his too long, rose-gold hair flopping down.
"Sorry to disturb, sir, but it's the messenger boy again with another wire."
"A second cable?"
"Yes, sir. It's dated earlier."
"Earlier?"
Sokoban hears the exasperation in his own voice.
"Why not just bring it with the first one?"
Wyndham nervously shifts between his feet, prompting the floorboards to groan. Sokoban is well aware that the clerk's right leg is several inches shorter than his left, and that he must wear a specially outfitted shoe to make up the difference. If not for the leg, Wyndham would likely be rotting in some Picardy hellhole this very moment. The trenches are full of wide-eyed farm boys who've had to trade their pitchforks for rifles. And worse.
"This putrid war," Sokoban thinks,
suddenly unable to tamp down the anger.
"This putrid, godforsaken war."
"Well, I can't say, sir. You should know the wire is dated from several days ago."
"Several days?"
Sokoban breathes in, telling himself that the fault isn't his clerk's.
"Never mind. Send him in."
The rumpled message is short, an attempt to notify the vice consul's office of Meyer's disappearance as the SS Feng Yang Maru passed Nanking on its way to the coast. The sender is Inwood, the steamboat's captain, and on the list of those to be interviewed by the Shanghai consulate today. Sokoban guesses from the name that Inwood is like a lot of Yangtze sailors, an old British sea dog who's hired himself out to the highest bidder. Sokoban reads the June 2nd timestamp with considerable frustration. Had he received Inwood's wire on time, he could have anticipated the Consul General's cable and launched the search for Meyer from Nanking himself. As it is, Sokoban's lost some 72 hours he could have been out searching for the missing man. When he presses the uniform deliverer why it's taken 3 days to bring a message marked urgent, the boy avoids his eye and stumbles about in broken English. It was the other boy, Sokoban pieces together, who failed to bring the wire. Still new and very young, this other one was too afraid to press the bell of the town's number one American. Sokoban dismisses the deliverer and adds the telegram to the growing stack. He wipes his forehead, only to find his handkerchief hopelessly twisted with sweat. He tells himself it's just a bout of nerves, the thought of undertaking an important case alone. In Shanghai, before his promotion, there'd always been a team handling such matters. And he knew the city, at least as well as an American ever could. But he's only been in Nanking a matter of months. Upriver remains an even greater mystery. With the exception of Arthur's house in Wuhu, that deep in the interior might as well be uncharted territory.
"Sir?"
He looks up. Inexplicably, the junior clerk is still in the doorway, seesawing between his uneven legs. Sokoban waits for Wyndham to speak, but the young man's lips remain shut, his usual grin replaced with a sober expression that looks far beyond his years. Is there something you wish to say, Mr. Wyndham?
Yes, sir. I was just wondering, I mean, this business with the missing man?
What about it?
What I mean is, well, will you be all right going up river, sir?
If Sokoban's lungs weren't crying for a cigarette, he'd find the youth's fear touching. The truth is, he's grown quite fond of the junior clerk these past months. Nanking is Wyndham's first foreign post. Sokoban still remembers the keen ache of loneliness he felt during his initial months at university, and this with only a move from Newark to Manhattan. But Sokoban's patience has begun to slip with the sweat now sliding down his cheek. The missing man, the impending trip upriver, the late wire, it's all ambushed him and left him feeling on edge. At this point, what he wants more than anything is to shut the door and fill himself with smoke.
No need to worry yourself on that front, Mr. Wyndham, he manages. We haven't received any reports of fighting around Wuhu. Now, if you don't mind, I have much to consider before heading out tomorrow.
I didn't exactly mean that, sir.
Sokoban grips the arms of his chair.
Out with it, Mr. Wyndham.
I was wondering if a missing persons case might not prove...
Wyndham clears his throat.
Difficult, sir, considering all that's happened.
All that's happened?
At last, Wyndham stills his restless feet and pushes back his hair. Concern briefly ripples across the clerk's forehead, and for a moment, Sokoban sees the older man Wyndham will one day become. The thought nearly breaks his heart.
I meant with your brother, sir.
Sokoban searches Wyndham's face, but the earnestness he finds there is unbearable, and he drops his eyes to the paperweight. In the blurry air, the small boat appears to move.
My personal affairs have nothing to do with this office or Mr. Meyer's case. I'm certain that I and the interpreter will manage.
Of course, sir. I didn't mean to imply you wouldn't...
That will be all, Sokoban says, cutting him off.
He can't have the clerk looking at him another minute. He knows it's irrational, but at times he swears Wyndham can read his thoughts.
Save emergencies. No more interruptions for the rest of the afternoon. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Close the door behind you, then.
The lock clicks, muffling the sound of Miss Petrie's typewriter. Sokoban stares at the brown slab, as if assuring himself of the door's continued stillness. He sheds his jacket and pulls at his tie, hoping for some relief from the heat. When it doesn't come, he unbuttons his shirt collar and places it atop the fluttering stack of papers. He runs his palm over the scrimshaw's cool surface, willing his heart to slow, but it's no use. Wyndham's words continue to hang in the swollen air, considering all that's happened. He tugs open the bottom drawer. The Chesterfields are there, exactly where Sokoban left them on the blue envelopes. He presses his finger to his own name spelled out in sepia ink across the topmost envelope, then shuts the drawer before the temptation to reach for his brother's letters can overtake him. He flicks open his lighter and draws down the searing air. Unlike the rest of his colleagues, he's avoided buying a silver case to house the cigarettes. Too permanent, he supposes. Too flashy. Besides, he's come to like the feel of the innovative packaging, its slick, waterproofed coating. Chesterfield, his brother's brand. A cigarette for soldiers. For war. As far as he knows, Ethan hadn't smoked before joining up. And yet, each of the three letters in Sokoban's desk drawer is pierced by tiny burn holes, where ash clearly dropped onto the onion skin. The Chesterfields were all the rage with the other flyers, his brother wrote from his base in France. Every airman got them as part of his rations.
A few drags and my fingers feel ready for the Bosch.
It's how Sokoban still likes to picture Ethan. A bundle of muscle and sinew, his drawers loose and dog tags clinking as he rises from his cot.
sliding one firm leg after the other into a thick jumpsuit, making a side-lipped wisecrack, and laughing with the others as they snap flints. Ethan's clean, wide palms reaching for a leather trench coat and cap on the hook. A Chesterfield between his lips, flashing orange against Dawn's cool blue. Sokoban inhales deeply, holding down the smoke, containing it. He shuts his eyes, willing the images to come. Eventually they do. Streaks of fire across the night sky. The strafed wing. White plume streaming from the engine as the small plane hurtles like a bright meteor toward the black-colored sea. For a moment, it isn't Ethan in the cockpit, but Sokoban himself. He keeps the cigarette between his lips, wanting to feel the burn of its advancing heat. Every instinct tells him to break free from the cockpit, to push up and out into the wide darkness. But gravity's hold is too strong. He's pinned to the spinning dashboard, barely able to breathe, unable to tell up from down, the throttle shoved hard against his chest like a knife shaft. He waits for the inevitable, the nosedive, the spiraling free fall toward the water below. Fatal surrender. He hears the scream of the engine, only to realize the cry is his own. Sokoban opens his eyes. Within moments, the plane and dark sea are lost to the clip-clop of the ceiling fan above. Other sounds seep through the door. The faint strike of Miss Petrie's typewriter keys, the slap of a file drawer. Voices. Mr. Brundage's southern drawl. Laughter. It's cruel irony. The ash on his cigarette is curling, threatening to fall. A cracked teacup has been standing in for a tray, and he taps the Chesterfield against the rim, watching as the cinders collapse in a silent heap on the bottom. He doesn't know if the images in his head bear any resemblance to the truth, or are simply the wild whims of his imagination. Nor can Sokoban say how they first came to him, only that he can't stop them from appearing. Nor does he want them to. The fact is, he knows nothing of his brother's whereabouts, if he is even still alive. It's been nearly 3 months since Ethan's plane failed to return from a night mission. Aside from the trio of letters in Sokoban's desk drawer and a single photograph, the images in his head are all he has of his brother's life as a soldier. He runs his fingers over the paperweight, sees the cables, and remembers. Meyer. Tomorrow, he'll be headed upriver for who knows how long. He needs to get out of the office and clear his head. Take a walk, go to a tea house, or simply go home to his rooms a few blocks away. But inertia has already set in, and he does none of these things. His legs feel heavy, his head thick with fog. Sokoban can't bear the thought of returning to the small apartment right now. He can't escape himself there with nothing or no one to distract him. And the windows don't overlook the water. The river. He can't say why, but he needs to see it. He takes a long drag and tells himself, even as he slides out another Chesterfield from the package, that it will be his last. At 5:30, Wyndham's muffled voice wishes him a good night through the door.
Sorry to interrupt, sir, but we're about to head out for the day. Mr. Lynn has sent word back that he's available. I have his resume here.
Sokoban sees the slice of hovering shadow at the threshold. He knows the clerk is lingering on the other side, nervously shifting between his mismatched legs and waiting for some sign of life within. The moment stretches into an eternity before Sokoban can manage the requisite response. Shame breaks across his chest like a wave. To have been finally promoted to vice consul, only to hide from his own staff like a frightened boy.
Leave the resume on your chair, Sokoban says. I'll get it on my way out.
Will do. Good night, sir.
The shadow recedes and Sokoban listens for the trio of foot.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?